Right, this is the next part of handout one, to do with torsion. We're going to start with uniform thin-walled circular cylinders, and because they're so beautifully axisymmetric, we can say immediately that the shear stress will vary it as a constant all the way around the cross-section. So as we apply a torque as shown like this, clearly this will twist and we will get shear stress, which is uniform, existing around the cross-section. Now, I want you to look at this little diagram. This is the important one. We have a thickness, little T, across here. That's the thickness of the wall. We have a little subtended angle of delta theta, giving us a little cross-sectional area there over which the shear stress tau is acting. So remember that in the next page, because on the next page, how much torque does that little piece give us? Well, it gives us its area, which is the thickness multiplied by RD theta, the subtended length of that little arc, multiplied by the shear stress acting, that gives us force, and then if we multiply it by the lever arm, that gives us the torque which that little piece of cross-section is contributing. And then, of course, what we do is we sum up the torque across the entire cross-section by integrating from 0 to 2 pi. We do that very simple integration by substituting the result that we found just above, and we find that the shear stress tau is equal to t divided by 2 pi r squared t. Very, very quick, very simple for a circular hollow cross-section. But what about the more general case? How are we going to deal with that when the shear stress may no longer be constant around the section? So here's a typical cross-section where the wall thickness is not a constant all the way around. It varies. And if that's the case, we might expect the shear stress to vary around the cross-section too. So let's study that a little bit more closely. We're going to define something called shear flow. Shear flow, this is a useful thing to do. Shear flow is the shear force per unit wall length of the structure, and it is the shear stress multiplied by the thickness of material. So in other words, if we go back a couple of pages, the shear flow in a thin-walled cylinder would have been T divided by 2 pi r squared if we had multiplied both sides of the equation by little t. So that's shear flow. And then we can say to ourselves, well, for a normal situation where we have equal thickness on two sides of a block, or in other words, it's a uniform thickness everywhere in this block, the total force acting from left to right at the top of that block must equal the total force acting from right to left. So we can say that tau dash there multiplied by t must be equal top and bottom, and therefore it's always a constant, which means that if the two shears are the same, if we multiply them by the thickness, they're the same, which means that the shear flow is the same. In other words, complementary shear flow also exists for any cross-section. But the question arises, of course, you know, what happens when we have a varying thickness, not a constant thickness? So this is thickness over here, T1, and that's thickness over there, T2. What happens then? Well, we still have to have horizontal equilibrium. The force from left to right must still equal the force from right to left, which means that that force will be the shear 2, tau 2, multiplied by T2 times the length must equal tau 1 times T1 times the length. Of course, the lengths disappear, which tells us that the shear flow Q1 must equal the shear flow Q2. That's what it tells us, which tells us that the shear flow is a constant around a thin-walled section. That is a very important, very simple, but very important result. And we're going to use that in a second. So, when we apply this shear stress, apply the torque around a cross-section where the thickness can vary, let's try now work out what the contribution will be towards the torque from each part of the cross-section. So let's choose this little one over here. We will call it a length delta L. Just by chance, as we're going to use this result in a second, just look to see that the area of that triangle there, which we're going to call delta A enclosed, is going to be equal to a half times delta L times R. Just remember that. And any force which is given to us by the shear stress tau over this little area here, if I take that force and multiply it by R, the perpendicular distance to that force, that will be the contribution from that shear stress to the torque about the centre of rotation O. So let's do all those sums. The little contribution to the torque from that little piece will be its area multiplied by the shear stress acting, multiplied by the lever arm, as we spoke about in the previous page. But we know that tau times t is a constant. which means, but well, we also know that delta L times R, delta L times R, is equal to twice the enclosed area of that triangle. So very briefly, I'm going to bring that bit back. The enclosed area of the triangle is a half times delta R times delta L times R, and therefore, if we have delta L times R, it is equal to twice that enclosed area. And it's that is the shaded area which was shown in the previous page. And we normally draw that to mid-thickness of the cross-section, which means from the top to the bottom, we know that the little contribution of delta T from that little piece is twice the shear flow multiplied by that little piece of enclosed triangular area. And of course, what we now do is we integrate that across the whole cross-section. This little circle in the middle of the integral sign you might have come across before, it's called a line integral. We basically can take Q out of the integral because we know it's a constant, and the integral of dA enclosed, of course, is the area enclosed, which means that the torque being applied is twice the shear flow multiplied by the enclosed area, which means that we can turn that equation around, and the shear flow is T divided by twice the enclosed area. Very, very handy result indeed. If we then divide both sides by the little t, we find that the shear stress at any point in the cross-section is given by the torque divided by twice the enclosed area times the thickness. And of course, if you want to find the highest shear stress at any point in a cross-section, we divide by the thinnest part of the cross-section. All of these equations that we've been talking about, they're applicable only to closed cross-sections. The moment we have an open cross-section, we have something completely different. And we cannot apply these formula. By the way, if you go back a few pages, you remember when we had the circular cross-section, we discovered that tau was equal to t divided by 2 pi r squared t. Pi r squared is the enclosed area of a circle. So what about stiffeners? In a nutshell, stiffeners make no difference to the shear stress being applied from torque. It will be entirely unaffected. Why? Because the enclosed area is unaffected by the presence of stiffness. So let's go back to the case study that we were dealing with last time, the Stilgar bridge, the approach span. Just imagine now if one end of the span, instead of being lifted through the middle, it was lifted by one of its corners. So we know what the reaction is at one end. We've already discovered that on previous pages. That equilibrium situation, well, that loading situation there is identical to this loading situation where we can move the force to the center and then apply, in addition, the moment which we get from that force multiplied by the distance to the center, which is about 12.5 meters. So we know what the torque is being applied and we know what the lifting force is being applied. We're only really interested in the torque at the moment. We know that the shear flow is T divided by 2AE, and the torque we know is about 99 mega Newton meters. So we plug all that information in. The enclosed area we have to discover. The enclosed area is the average width of the two flanges multiplied by the vertical height of the cross section. So 121 square meters, that tells us what the shear flow is. When we've got the shear flow, we have to divide by the thinnest part of the cross section, which happens to be in the webs. And in the webs, it is only 10 millimeters thick. So we take the shear flow, divide it by the by the thickness of the material, 0.01 meters in this particular case. That tells us that the shear stress is about 41 newtons per square millimeter. And 41 newtons per square millimeter for steel in shear is a medium-sized shear stress. Structural steel can take about 170, 180. So 41, that's medium-sized. And remember, this is only to do with torque. The calculation we've just done ignores, so far, any effect due to the shear force itself at the end of the structure. This is just due to twisting. So you can see that when you add all the other bits and pieces together, stresses build up really rather quickly. Now, let's talk about something completely different. Strain in three dimensions. Strains are always, you'll remember from 1A structures, they're always very small, of the order of 10 to the minus 3. Actually, they're normally 10 to the minus 6. We normally talk about microstrain. And remember that strains are dimensionless. So normal strains, they give us normal stress, will give us normal strains. So we'll get epsilon xx, epsilon yy, epsilon zz if we apply sigma xx, sigma yy, or sigma zz to any form of material. But shear strain is something a little different. Shear strain deforms material by some form of angle. So we're going to refer to certain faces. That we're going to call the y-face because it's perpendicular to the y-axis, and we'll call that one the x-face, perpendicular to the x-axis. And when this material is deformed through shear, it will shear strain, and that shear strain we're going to call gamma xy, and gamma xy is measured in radians. So we talk about something multiplied by 10 to the minus 6 radians, usually when we talk about shear strains. Small numbers, but remember it is an angle of shear strain. So these are all the same. If we have a material which deforms into that, or into that, or into that, these three are all exactly the same. They're all undergoing exactly the same shear strain. Sometimes we draw each of these for various effects and various reasons. So get used to that. When something undergoes shear strain, all of the sides remain exactly the same length as they ever were before. It's just that the angles vary, and so we get this parallelepiped effect in material. Okay, now we're going to use a very simple model, and we're going to use some very important words. We will use a linear elastic, homogeneous, isotropic, time-independent model. So what do these terms mean? It's important you wrap your head around these terms. First one, elastic. That means that any deformation which we impose will disappear completely when the load's removed. In other words, there's no plasticity at all. Linear means that variation in stress strain is linear. It is a straight line. Homogeneous, it means that the material does not vary with position, and its behavior does not vary with position. Isotropic, its behavior does not vary with direction. And of course, a classic example where that cannot possibly be true would be for a fiber-reinforced material, where we have all the fibers lined up in one direction. And the other bit which we talked about was time-independent. In other words, our material does not creep. So these are assumptions that we're making at the start before talking about strain. Okay, now let's talk about what happens in various directions. If we apply a normal stress, as we are doing in this case, to this block of material, and we stretch it, as we stretch it in the x direction through sigma xx, I hope it makes very good sense to you that it will contract in the other direction. So as we stretch it in this direction, it contracts in the other two directions, y and z. So in the x direction, we have a strain epsilon xx, which is equal to sigma xx divided by e. But in the y direction, the strain in the y direction, which is the same as the strain in the z direction, is some fraction of that strain in the x direction which is being applied. And it's negative because it's a contraction if epsilon xx is positive. In other words, if epsilon xx is an extension. So we will see that the strain it built up in the cross section in the other two directions is negative, multiplied by this fraction, multiplied by epsilon xx. So that fraction is known as Poisson's ratio. In other words, epsilon y is equal to epsilon epz is equal to minus Poisson's ratio times sigma xx divided by e. So Poisson's ratio, typical values for steel 0.3, aluminium 0.33, cork is 0, rubber is about 0.5, almost 0.5. The maximum value that Poisson's ratio can be, is 0.5, and you'll be asked to prove that in one of the examples papers. There are also some values given there for Young's modulus. It's very important that you have Young's modulus numbers very much at your fingertips as structural engineers. Right, let's introduce something which is called anticlastic curvature. What this is when we stretch something, and the classic example is to use use an eraser between your fingers, have a look at it as it bends. As we stretch the material at the bottom, and we're bending it like this, so we're stretching the bottom, then of course as the bottom stretches, in the other directions it contracts through Poisson's ratio. And in other words, it gets shorter in this direction. And at the top where it's in compression and it becomes shorter, it extends in the second and third direction. So we have this behavior where we have curvature not just in the direction in which we're bending the rubber, we have curvature in the other direction too. And that is known as anticlastic behavior, and it's entirely due to Poisson's ratio effects. Right, now let's talk about temperature change. Temperature is a terribly important part of structural engineering. So an unrestrained body, which has a temperature rise, will undergo a uniform expansion without changing shape. And it means that the strain in all the directions will be equal to the coefficient of linear expansion, alpha, multiplied by the change in temperature. That's what we have. And so typical values of alpha, steel, 11 times 10 to the minus 6 per Kelvin. That's a number which you will grow to simply know. The normal strain due to 3D normal stress in that case is, if we have some sigma x being applied, then in the x direction, the strain in the x direction is simply that stress in the x direction divided by Young's modulus. But if there's also strain applied in the y and the z direction, we need to subtract the strain due to Poisson's ratio effects from the y direction and from the z direction, because those direction stresses would affect epsilon xx. And if we then also add on the temperature effects that we've just discovered on the previous page, this gives you the formula which you'll find in page one of your data book. So this is the very general strain approach that we use in all the directions when it comes to three-dimensional strain analysis. Right, shear strain. A shear stress in the X face acting in the Y direction and its complementary stress in the Y face in the X direction will cause a shear strain in the XY plane, but no shear strains on the YZ or ZX planes. That's important. That's unlike the Poisson's ratio system that we have for the normal strains in some form in a material. We also know that gamma XY, the shear strain, is equal to 1 over G. G is the shear modulus of tau xy, that's the linear elastic relationship that we have. And we know that G and E and Poisson's ratio are related by this formula. And again, you will prove that in example sheet 2.2. And in an isotropic material, shear stress will cause no normal strain in any direction. They are separate things. Normal strain and shear strain are simply mutually exclusive, if you like, if I can put it that way. So let's now have a look at a closed pressurized cylinder. We have, in a situation like this, we know that the tangential stress is about zero. We discovered that previously. We know what the longitudinal stress is, PR over 2T, and we know what the hoop stress is, PR over T, as we have discovered in the past. So what are the strains which we have? Well, the longitudinal strain will be simply be given by, there's no temperature involved, remember, the longitudinal strain will be given by 1 over E, 1 over Young's modulus, multiplied by the longitudinal stress minus Poisson's ratio times the hoop stress minus Poisson's ratio times the transverse stress. We plug in what we have on the previous page and we get that solution. And in the hoop direction, the strain in the hoop direction will be given by a very similar type of formula, and we can plug the numbers in and we can get a similar sort of result. The through wall thickness, the strain, in other words, the strain, the amount that the wall thickness wants to change in thickness, is also given by a similar formula. And note that in this particular case, even though the stress in the transverse direction is zero, we still have a strain, and that's what's written there. So the change in dimensions now, let's have a look at the length. The change in length divided by length, which is, of course, epsilon L. The change in length will be epsilon L times L. And in a circumferential direction, the change in circumference divided by the circumference is, of course, the hoop strain. It's the strain in that hoop direction. What about the change in radius divided by the radius? And this is nothing to do with the strain in a through wall thickness. The change in radius divided by the radius, that change in radius is not the same as the change in wall thickness divided by wall thickness. And it turns out that the change in radius divided by radius, if you multiply top and bottom by 2 pi, it's the same as change in circumference divided by circumference. In other words, it's the hoop strain. So we can discover that nice and easily, which means we can now talk about the change in volume. So if we define a volumetric strain as the change in volume divided by the volume, then the volume enclosed by a cylinder is pi r squared L. And we can find the partial derivatives with respect to L and with respect to R. And for small variations around a current position, we know that the change in volume is the partial dV by the L times delta L plus the partial dV by the R times delta R. We can plug the numbers in, and that's what we get. We then divide both sides of the formula by the volume. And if we do that, we're getting the volumetric strain on the left-hand side, and we will find that on the right-hand side we get this result, which means that it's simply those two strains added together, and we can come up with a very particular answer. And then what we can do is multiply that by the volume to give us the change in volume, and we'll get this thing. And it means we can work out in, for instance, millilitres, what the change in the volume of a pressure vessel is, for instance. What about the change in metal in the wall? Exactly the same process. The volume in the wall is equal to twice the circumference times the thickness times the length. We do the partial derivatives with respect to each of the variables. They're all linear, which means that if they're all linear, it's obvious we're going to end up with a formula which looks like that for the change in volume. We add all the strains together and we get that solution for the volumetric change, for the volumetric strain for the material in the cross-section. If we then multiply that by the original volume of material, that is what we get in terms of the change in material. And this is our last example in this particular video. Thermal stresses. We have a situation here where we have a closed cylinder, and it is between two immovable walls, and we increase the temperature by 100 degrees. So what are we going to do? Well, actually, this is a statically indeterminate structure. It's not easy to solve unless you take into account compatibility, because we don't know what the relationship is between the force acting on the wall and the stresses in the longitudinal direction without taking into account the fact that we have compatibility. So what is the compatibility? The compatibility is that the longitudinal strain is zero, because that material will not stretch in length as the temperature increases. It can't, because the walls are in place. So if we know that, we know that the hoop stress is zero, because there's no internal pressure. We know that the transverse stress is zero, because it's always zero, even if there was internal pressure. So those two parts disappear, and we have a very simple formula to find the longitudinal stress in the material, which comes down in this particular case to a compression of 154 newtons per square millimetre, very high if it's a thin-walled steel cross-section, and very, very high if it's some form of alloy which is not as strong as steel, or not as stiff as steel, not only for buckling but also potentially for yield. So that's what's mentioned on the next page. We could get either yielding or we could get buckling of that material. So at this point, you're now in a position where you can try questions 5, 6, and 7 of example sheet 2-1.